Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey out there, rock and rollers. Welcome to episode number 136 of the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast. Brought to you by me, your host, Mac B. the Wolf. And I will be joined, as always, by my partner in crime from the East Coast of the U.S., Gary Action Jackson. And in fact, Jackson is just north of the hometown of the band that we're going to be featuring on this show, which is right around the 4th of July. So I wanted to pick a very American band for this 4th of July Independence Day kind of show. And we decided to go with Lynyrd Skynyrd out of Jacksonville, Florida, whose debut album, pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd, debuted about 50 years ago as we're releasing this show. And as someone who lived in Jacksonville for a long time, I know, and Jackson knows because he's right in the wheelhouse down there, that folks down there still love Lynyrd Skynyrd. And if you listen to classic rock radio, you listen for an hour, you're going to hear Lynyrd Skynyrd. If you listen for a half an hour, you got a pretty good chance. People still love to hear these great songs from these guys who came from really rough roots to become a fantastic hard rock band. They kind of just get labeled with that southern rock thing a lot, but I feel like they were much more than that. Their riffs were fantastic, and Ronnie Van Zant is a much better songwriter than he ever gets credit for. He probably just gets denigrated because he's from the South. But I gotta tell you, you listen to these songs, especially on this first record, I think you're gonna be blown away with how good they are, just how down and dirty, honky-tonk, good time, but still very hard rock and roll. It's not country. It's very much rock and roll. And they were awfully good at it. And they deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame where they are. And this is before the real classic lineup solidified, because Ed King, who would be one of their three guitar players, was actually playing bass. Leon Wilkinson had left the band for a little while. Ed King was intended to play the guitar. He comes in to play the bass. But then Ronnie decides, nah, we need Ed on the guitar. So we go back, get Leon back, and now they've got three guitars between Ed King, Alan Collins, and Gary Rossington. Really created an amazing sound. And this first album was the foundation of it because it had huge, huge hits on it and songs that would be staples of their catalog and live shows for years to come, like Gimme Three Steps, like Tuesday's Gone, and like the totally epic Freebird, which you can't even go to a bar where there's a band playing Southern Rock and not hear someone in the crowd say, play some Freebird. But at the end of those sessions, there was also another song that ended up on their second album. They wanted to maybe squeeze on the first album, but there was no time. It was a little ditty called Sweet Home Alabama. So obviously this is a very important time for the band in 1973 to get this lineup together, to work with Al Kooper, who was a Blood, Sweat, and Tears fan and fame and had worked with Bob Dylan, among others, as a producer. He helped them put these songs together, get it out, and get it out to the world. Plus, he hooked them up with Pete Townsend of The Who, who was his friend, who booked them as the opening act on the Quadrophenia tour. Wow, heady days indeed. Now we need to quickly take care of a little bit of business. As usual, we need to mention that we are proud members of Pantheon Podcast Network, a network of about 100 different shows, all music related. Not all rock and roll, but there is something in there for everyone. And we have guested on many of those shows, and we've had some of those guests on our show before. Go out to pantheonpodcast.com to learn more, or follow them at Pantheon Pods. And of course, we have to talk about our fantastic sponsor out of the UK, RareVinyl.com. Guys, Rare Vinyl has been in business for 40 years, okay? They ship albums and CDs and tour programs and posters and whatever you might find in their catalog of over a quarter of a million items. They ship it all over the world. So it doesn't matter if you're in Timbuktu or Tennessee, you can go to rarevinyl.com, find something that you love, and then use the code UGLY, U-G-L-Y, to knock 10% off of your shipments. I know we have a lot of record collectors out there, and there's definitely Skynyrd fans out there who want something nice, maybe a pristine first edition or something that you can't find everywhere. Go to rarevinyl.com, use the code UGLY, and save yourself 10% off your purchases. Now, I was fortunate enough to meet Lynyrd Skynyrd, at least the surviving members of Lynyrd Skynyrd, in 1991 when they did the comeback record, Lynyrd Skynyrd 1991. Met him at a record store, got him to sign my CD. Thought it was super cool, and I've been listening to him really ever since, and before that too. I remember distinctly listening to Freebird in the car, the end, the solo with my dad, just not wanting to get out of the car, even though it was like 20 below zero. We're like, listen to those guitars, would you hear that? It's unbelievable. It's iconic, it's huge. Everyone knows Freebird, and the three guitar attack makes them powerful. They have a long legacy, especially in the South and the Southeast, and we're going to celebrate it here on 4th of July week. This is Lynyrd Skynyrd's first album, pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd, at 50, right here on The Wolf.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
So growing up in the Northeast, you probably had a different, exposure or thoughts about Lynyrd Skynyrd than you do now, living basically in their backyard. Or like when we went to school in Florida and we would visit like my folks in Jacksonville and we listened to classic rock and like every fifth or sixth song was Lynyrd Skynyrd, right? It must have been a different experience growing up in the Northeast. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. You asked me about, when we were talking about Blue Oyster Cult, you asked me, they're from New York, was that a big deal? No, it wasn't, because everybody was from New York. Down here, you're right, it's all Lynyrd Skynyrd all the time. And yeah, growing up in the Northeast, it was pretty much just Sweet Home Alabama, Freebird, and maybe a couple other ones that you'd heard of. But yeah, they were the other problem too was growing up at that time, in the mid to late 80s, early 90s, they were already gone. The plane crash was in 77. This was already kind of old news. Whereas a lot of the other bands that we like were kind of having a resurgence in the late 80s, early 90s. I know they came back. I know they kind of reformed in 91, but that was still with Johnny. So yeah, growing up, they were just kind of like a one or two hit band, and that was it up in Connecticut.
Yeah, and I grew up in the Midwest, obviously. And I mean, look, once you get into guitars like I did in the late 80s when we were in high school, you can't ignore something like Freebird, right? I mean, it's a guitar anthem. That jam at the end is huge. And then obviously, as we got a little bit older, that song kind of became bigger thanks to some movies and stuff like that. But it also kind of became a bit of a cliche, right? It's like, play Freebird.
always somebody in the back screaming, play Freebird. Yes.
And I think you can even hear that on One More From the Road, the live album.
Geez.
Where he's like, okay, which song do you want to hear? What are they saying? Free? Well, it's the one you haven't played yet. Okay, how about that one? You know? An epic jam, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the whole Southern rock thing really took off in the early 70s, thanks to the Allman Brothers, thanks to the great work of Dwayne on his slide guitar and Brother Greg there and the rest of the boys. I mean, Live at the Fillmore was a huge song, I mean, a huge record for them, kind of opened up the doors to a lot of things and turned a lot of people on to Southern rock. And then you started to see more people kind of coming through that door, like Lynyrd Skynyrd and Molly Hatchet. You know, Mountain with Leslie West were already, you know, a bit of a deal, all right. But yeah, it was like everybody's from New York or everyone's from California or wherever. But then you started seeing, all right, you got this kind of Southern, it's got a little blues, it's got a little country in it, maybe a little bit of folk, plus their own thing. And it kind of created a sound. Molly Hatchet, I guess you could throw in there as well. I think they're also from Jacksonville.
Yeah, they are.
So yeah, suddenly there's this new sound that people are starting to find attractive.
Now, and looking back on it now or thinking about it now, when I figured out what was going on in that band, I think what made them great also kind of hurt them. You know, we talk about, we love Jimmy Page. Who's the guitar player in Led Zeppelin? It is, was, and always will be Jimmy Page.
That's right.
In The Who, it's Pete Townsend. You know, in Pink Floyd, it's David Gilmour. And in Lynyrd Skynyrd, wait, they had three? Wait, right. That's very confusing. And who's playing lead on this and who's playing? So while, and definitely going back and listening to this record, you can tell that they're all great players. I think that back and forth of you didn't really know who was playing what kind of almost hurt them from a rock god perspective.
A little bit. Yeah, I'm kind of with you there because obviously now it's been 50 years since it's been out. We want to look at it through critics' eyes and say, all right, let's pick it apart a little bit. You know, what was good, what was bad, all that kind of thing. Not to mention on this one, Ed King, who at times may have been their best guitar player. He doesn't even play guitar really on this. He plays on a couple of tracks.
Which I didn't realize either until doing research for this, because it's not, they've got all six guys on the cover. Leon's on the cover. So you think, oh, okay, well, he played bass. No, he did not.
Right. I think it's all seven guys, though.
Oh, seven guys. That's
seven.
Right.
Yeah, I think
and,
seven, yeah.
And you know, honestly, that might have been part of the thing, too. Now, thinking about it, like, there's way too many guys in that band. I can't even keep them straight.
Right. Yeah, you're right about that. And they had been together for 10 years in various incarnations before this first one came out. It's not like they were together for a couple of years. Then they got the record deal and went out, you know. So, yeah, going back, they're all from Jacksonville, Florida, and generally speaking from the west side of Jacksonville. And it's someone who's lived in Jacksonville myself for a long time, and you who've lived close by now in southern Georgia for a long time. That's it's kind of the rougher side of town, right? I mean, you know, it's honestly where, like, poor white people, very working class people live. And it's rough. I mean, it's hard growing up there. And if, you know, these guys hadn't made it in a band, well, God knows what would have happened to them, right? Because they were kind of rough and tumble kind of guys.
That's what it seemed like. It seemed like they, yes, they loved to play, but they were also like looking to get into trouble or at least looking to fight. They were at one point in time, they were talking about how they would play for a lot of, like, because this is a big, Jacksonville's a huge Navy town.
Right.
So they play for a lot of sailors, and you know what they wanted to do after they had a couple of beers, and they were more than happy to oblige with a parking lot skirmish at the end of the
right. Yeah, the, I mean, they're off the boat, they're there to get drunk, and then they either want to screw or they want to fight,
right? And especially in the early 70s, where look at these long-haired, you know, yeah, musician exactly. types. Let's they need an ass kicking.
But Ronnie was, you're more than happy to oblige him. He'd fight anybody, man.
Correct. Yes,
I mean, he's a tough guy.
More than happy to. You know, the interesting thing about Ronnie, which I don't know if I knew, didn't know, didn't really think about, the fact that he's just kind of a small dude, like short in stature, but he always performed barefoot. So like it's not like he ever cared. Like he wasn't a guy that wore like big heels or cowboy boots or anything. He's like, this is me. This is who I am. And yeah, you want to say something about it, I will put my hand through the back of your head.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't just to folks who would approach him in bars, or, you know, it might even been to a reporter. You know, it's like, if he starts asking questions, you know, like, he's like, yeah, well, how do you think you're going to get out of this hotel room right now?
And I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine what that feels like, where it's like, oh, he's not kidding. Oh, he's right. Really upset about whatever you just told him. And now he's looking to put you in your place. Yeah, no thanks.
Even producer Al Cooper, who did their first three records, and he kind of, he formed Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and then he kind of went on to become a producer and worked with Dylan and you know, kind of made his name that way. But when, you know, they're recording Simple Man, he's like, yeah, I'm not hearing this. I don't think this is good. I don't think it's going to be on the record. Ronnie basically walked him out to his car and said, we'll finish up this. You can go the fuck home, you know? And he's like, I was scared of Ronnie. And like, yeah, you should have been, because he would have ripped you one if he wanted to.
Now, that's an interesting concept, too, that I didn't think about. And again, being from the North, it didn't really click with me until I watched the, what was it, If I Leave Here Tomorrow.
Great documentary, so, yeah.
Correct. And they were talking about, you know, growing up in Jacksonville, being from the South, it performing in front of the Confederate flag. And Gary Rossington was saying, you know, we never meant anything disrespectful. We never meant anything hurtful. Mm-hmm. We were just proud to be from the South. And at one point in time, the part about where they walked him out to the car, they referred to him as the Yankee slicker.
Uh-huh.
Somebody coming down. So then they get to where they're going. They go to Europe for the first time and they're like, oh, Yanks. And they're like, whoa, stop. No.
Right.
No, 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 no.
You don't call us that.
You're from America, right? Yeah. Then you're a Yankee. No, we're from the South. They just that thought of not being associated with anything from the North was interesting.
Yeah. And I also give Gary credit there, you know, for saying, look, we didn't know we were offending anybody. We certainly weren't trying to, but we know now that is offensive to people, you know, and we don't have that backdrop anymore. We don't do that anymore.
Correct.
You know, so it's like, you know, give people a chance to evolve and to learn and to grow. You know, you want to rip Lynyrd Skynyrd because they played in front of the Confederate flag in 1975. Fine. It's kind of like, you know, ripping John Wayne for something he said in Playboy in the 70s. I'm like, the dude is dead. Just let it go, you know, kind of thing. But they have evolved and realized that wasn't probably the best thing to do, but it wasn't their intention to come out as like promoting the Klan or being racist. Like, we're from the South and we're proud of it. Damn it.
Right.
You know, kind of thing.
And in that same vein, I know Neil Young has come out and said, okay, listen, I know in the song Southern Man, I made some very sweeping racial comments or cultural comments. I'm sorry. Not everybody from the South is like that, obviously. So I think, you know, I think we have evolved a little bit to not putting everybody in the same bucket. But
right.
That was always an interesting concept for me, because like, if you're from the North, no one really cares. No one has Northern pride. No one cares.
Right.
It's
like a pride about your town, right? You're like where you come from, like literally the town you went to high school in.
Right. Correct. but just that idea of having that Southern pride and being, you know, happy for where you came from. It's a different deal, but I definitely understand it more now.
Yeah. And you lived in Texas for a long time and you understand
Correct.
How people are proud about being Texan. That's for sure. Also the South, I would say.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So we come to this first album here after they gig around for a long time. You got Ronnie Van Zant on the vocals, not an amazing singer, but his songwriting is pretty poignant, I got to say. For a guy who doesn't have a lot of education, he understands how to communicate with people with a turn of phrase, man. He really does. And it can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people, his lyrics.
Right. And I think it really struck a chord with people who are from where he's from. You know, that working man, the blue collar person, you know, you I think you see a lot of your own life and what you've gone through in these songs, and especially in the lyrics.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And he co-writes every song that Skynyrd has ever done. You know, generally the different guitar players get songwriting credits on the stuff that they come up with. But Ronnie writes all the lyrics. And it's interesting because, you know, Ronnie apparently never wrote anything down. Ever. You know, and Bob Burns, who was like the drummer at the time, is like, Ronnie, man, why don't you write this stuff down? And basically his response was, if it ain't worth remembering, it ain't worth writing down anyway. And he worked the hell out of these guys. Like Al Kooper even said so in that documentary. He's like, they came in and you think, oh, well, they're this jam band, right? Because of Free Bird and the way they can really go off on some of these songs. But that's really not the case. They were a very practiced band and every note was just right, just the way Ronnie said that you needed to do it, you know? So that's kind of the way they were. He was in charge and they did as he said, basically.
Yeah. That was insane to hear about when they got to Muscle Shoals and whoever was talking about actually working with them in the studio said, I've never seen a band that was so polished and there were no changes to anything. Once they left that, what do they call that place? The Hell House.
Yeah, their big
They,
practice house down on the
yeah, they're,
river.
once they left and were ready to record, that was it. These songs were done, polished, and ready to be recorded. We're not going into the studio to find, find the sound or find inspiration. No, they were ready to roll.
Yeah, and they had some good talent in the band. I mean, Bob Burns was a solid drummer. Leon Wilkinson was on bass. Although sometimes I think Ricky Medlock, who is in the band now, he would come in and sometimes be a second drummer with Bob for a while. This is before they became recording artists. And then eventually he left. And they had Alan Collins, who'd been with them really since the beginning. Talk about them being rough and tumble. Ronnie had such a reputation that Ronnie came after Alan one day with Bob on their bikes. And Alan's like, uh-oh, this Ronnie guy's tough. He's going to come kick my ass. I'm going to get the hell out of here. So went and climbed a tree to get away from him. I'm like, no, dude, we're not here to kick your ass. We want you to join the band because we hear you're a heck of a guitar player. So, I mean, it goes back that far to when they're like 14 years old in high school. And crazy. And then, of course, Gary Rossington, the other lead guitar player they had really since the beginning as well.
Correct. Yeah. And that was the interesting thing, too. We were talking to Mick Wall about the Eagles, and he was saying they got a lot of backlash because they were seen as this manufactured band, guys that kind of just came together through being working musicians and then put a band together. You could not be farther off than Skynyrd, because I think what did Rossington say? Like, they started hanging around when he was like 12 or 13 years old.
Right.
And that was just it. They were just kids who wanted to be in a band.
Except the one outlier was Ed King. Now, Billy Powell was their piano player, and he had been their roadie. And I guess they were playing a dance at the Bowles School, which is a pretty fancy school in Jacksonville. Like, it's like rich kids go there. And I guess they played it because they had money to pay them for the gig. It's where Chipper Jones did his high school before he went
Oh,
on to
really?
it.
Okay.
Hall of Fame career with the Atlanta Braves. But yeah, very fancy place. But they kind of heard him playing a thing one morning, or when he's setting up, and they're like, okay, yeah, you need to join the band. And he added helped add that the piano opening on Freebird, which we'll get to. But the outlier is Ed King. Ed was from California, and he had been in Strawberry Alarm Clock, who had the big kind of 60s pseudo psychedelic pop incense peppermint song.
Mankind, dead kings, many things I can't define. Old Cajun spots, wagons, butter your mind. Incense and peppermints, the color of time. Who cares what games we choose? Little to win, but nothing to lose. Incense and
And I guess that while they were touring the South at some point in the late 60s or the early 70s, he had hooked up with those guys. They had maybe opened for Strawberry Alarm Clock or something like that. And he said, hey, you guys are, you kind of got it going on here. If you ever need anybody, give me a buzz. And so I guess Ronnie held on to that. And at some point, Leon decided he wanted to leave. So he split. Ed comes in and he's going to play the bass and not guitar. And there's a classic photo of them at Hell House where they come outside, and basically everybody in the band except for Ed is on the right side of the door, and Ed's kind of on the left by himself, right? Because he's not like them. He's from California. He's kind of a fat kid, no offense to Ed, but I mean, for a rock star, especially back then, he's kind of a chunky little booger, but a heck of a guitar player and could write some really good songs, among them Sweet Home Alabama. But we'll get to that. And then I think right before this comes out, he realized that Ed's too good of a guitar player to have him on the bass. Ronnie did. So he went to Leon and kind of convinced him that he needed to come back. And then they had the three guitar army, three guitar attack in place.
Yeah, kind of unorthodox at that point in time. And I know they kind of alluded it to a little bit in the movie, but I just wonder how much of a hurdle that was to overcome for Ed, for being so far away. And that probably not being able to relate to a lot of the things that the rest of the guys could, even like the way they spoke to each other, kind of the whole deal. I think he said when he got there, he had to spend like 2 weeks at the Hell House by himself at night, which, ew.
I know. Yeah, because renting one of those little cabins down the river wouldn't have cost them a whole lot. But if you're going to keep your equipment there, you got to make sure no one's coming to steal it. So, somebody's got to spend the night there. So, yeah, that's your initiation, rookie.
No heat, no air, nobody around. Ugh. Oh, and by the way, people may be trying to rob us. So just be on the lookout.
Yeah, not
That
to
was
mention there's
tomorrow.
gators in the water, there's cockroaches as big as your foot crawling around.
Hi, this is Mick Wall, and you are listening to the Ugly American Werewolf in London.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So some of these songs they've been doing for years, and they finally got the opportunity to record them. And so here we go with pronounced Leonard Skinner, which I guess was their old PE teacher was named Leonard Skinner, right?
Yes, correct.
So the story goes.
Yeah. And I think that was at a time when, you know, you were having that kind of cultural shift of he was probably, you know, a guy from the 50s that was
flat top
and, you know, give me 20 pushups. And these guys were long haired, you know, pot smoking hellions. And yeah, I can only imagine what, you know, every day you knew he was just going to go for it. Every day he was just going to pound your head in.
Yeah. All right. So we start off with this, an amazing debut. I mean, and it's the picture of him in Georgia, kind of on the street there. It's got all seven of them there. Another funny story is Rossington had been partying so hard that, you know, they took the pictures, and then a few seconds later he pukes all over the sidewalk. There's Prince Charming for you.
What I didn't realize, and that's a great story, but what I didn't realize is until I looked closely, Ed is on the end of the photo, and I guess they had taken it a couple of times, but for whatever reason, the one that they use, there's like a lightning strike right behind him. It looks like he's being hit by lightning.
Yeah, which is a rare
just kind of a cool, like, you know, not photoshopped or anything else, just something that happened.
Yeah. But see, that's also kind of part of him being an outsider as well. It's yeah. Like, all right, we're gonna lose a guy, it's gonna be this guy who's not really one of us, you know, kind of thing. Well, it starts off here. You got to come out rocking, right? So it starts out with I Ain't the One, which is a Rossington Van Zandt song. It's got a nice, rough, honky-tonk type of groove to it. It's a little bit strange at the very beginning with all the cymbal stuff going on. That threw me off, and I don't know if I'd ever really sat and listened to that before. I mean, I know the song, but I'd never heard in the first 6-8 seconds. It's kind of got all the cymbal stuff. I'm like, is that Bob Burns' idea? Well, where did that come from?
I don't know. And the problem with this record is you've got so many tracks on here that you know by heart.
Yeah.
It would be easy to skip this one to go right to Tuesday's Gone. But yeah, it's good. I like it. It's slow at the beginning, but it's kind of a little bit greasy. Mm-hmm. And then the boogie woogie piano comes in. One thing that was brought up that I really didn't realize is that for all of the hype that this gets of being a guitar record, it's really more of a piano record.
You're right.
Does a great job. And I can only imagine when they were like, He said something about playing piano. Like, you can play piano? Yeah, go ahead and do it. Well, what the hell have you been doing moving stuff around? You need to play full time with the band. I do like the sentiment in this one too, where it's like, you know what, baby, whatever you think, I ain't the one. Okay.
Yeah.
Stop it.
Yeah. Maybe for tonight, fine, but long term, no. It ain't me, babe. Yeah. No, it's a good opener. And it's got good rhythm to it. It's got a good honky groove to it. And it closes like with the big bang crash. Like everybody's jamming at the end, like, you know, like a lot of songs do. I'm like, okay, good way to open the record. Cool. And then they go into Tuesday's Gone. Now, look, we talk about sequencing of records a whole lot. And Tuesday's Gone is a great song. It's a classic, classic Skinner song. But to me, they should have put Gimme Three Steps second and Tuesday's Gone third.
Okay.
Because generally speaking, you start off with a rocker, and that's what I Ain't the One is. Then you want to kick it up a notch on track two, and that would be Gimme Three Steps, man. A real honky-tonk rocking single, right? And then you slow it down on the third track for Tuesday's Gone. Now, I mean, they probably figured, hey, let's get to this great song, which Tuesday's Gone is.
kind of a ballad, little bit of a lament.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have sequenced it different. I would have put that third, and I would have put Give Me Three Steps, which was the first single, second. But they didn't ask me. And it's not like nobody ever heard Give Me Three Steps, because, like, again, I said it was a single, or Tuesday's Gone, because that's been classic rock staple. I mean, you know, since we've been alive.
Right. And we were talking to Christy from Rock Is Lit about Dazed and Confused. And I just can't hear this song anymore without thinking of the end of the party at the Moon Tower, where the keg is empty and people are all bent out of shape, throwing the cups around because they got to leave. That will always now be a part of this song for me.
That'll absolutely, man. Absolutely. That song in that moment. And I mean, I think One More From the Road came out in 76, which is when that movie took place.
Oh, okay.
Like, last day of school, 1976, right? Uh-huh. So it would have been May or June of 76. So, like, that's just perfect, you know? And again, there's a lot of great piano on mm-hmm. here. Ed does play some guitar on here while Billy's doing his piano solo. And Cooper is on the Mellotron, which we learned a little bit about when we learned about the Pyrotron in mm-hmm. the episode we did with Kevin Mulrine on Yes's Tormato story. It's too long to be a single because it's over 7 minutes, but it does also have some great guitar stuff on it. I mean, I consider it more of a piano single at this point, more of a Billy song. And it's amazing that Billy never gets any like writing credit on these songs, because what he adds to the arrangement is iconic.
Yeah, I wondered how that worked with these guys, because you're right. There's no way anybody else wrote that for him. They just probably said, okay, here's the piano fill here, and he came up with it. Yeah, he does add a lot to this. And the guitar work on this, too, it's just right. It's not overpowering, but it fits in nice.
Yeah, and Alan Collins, I think, deserves a lot of credit. He was, for a long time, he was kind of my third favorite guitar player in the band, because he's kind of a quiet guy. He's tall and lanky. Ed wrote Sweet Home Alabama, so that's big time. You know, Gary wrote Freebird, so I'm like, well, that's pretty big time. Well, Gary and Alan wrote it together. So Gary and Ed were kind of my favorites. But Alan, I mean, his co-writes on this were Tuesday's Gone, Give Me Three Steps, and Freebird. Well, that's the class of the operation right there. Yeah, so he was obviously a damn fine guitar player. I think his stepmom was a classically trained guitarist, and it showed him a few things, and then he kind of took off from there. But this is, you know, it's kind of a ballad, but it's also got some great stuff in it. Lamentful lyrics by Ronnie. He's talking about his girl. I don't know. Some of his lyrics could mean different things to different people. And I think that's why a lot of his songs, besides just the riffs, have stood the test of time.
Yeah. Make of it what you will. Yeah. Definitely sadness and lament for something either ending. And yeah, I think that's what were the two singles off of this?
Well, it was Give Me Three Steps. And then later, much, much later, it was Freebird.
Okay. Yeah.
Because we got to talk about that at some point, because that was kind of a weird situation.
I've always thought of this as a single, even though I guess it never was. But yeah, just a real nice change of pace in the catalog, too. This, it's not a straight ahead rocker, and it just fits perfectly in the context of this record.
Right. Except I still, and you're, you know, it could have been a single, and thanks to FM radio, it kind of is, because it continues to go on. But it's too long to be a straight-up single, so they would have had to cut it. But yeah, I still think, as far as the tracks go, if you put Give Me Three Steps second, you come out with a rocker, then a real rocker, then you bring it back a bit, and then Simple Man fourth, the last song on there, kind of bring it on down. I don't know. That's the way I would see it. But again, it sold 2 million copies in the U.S. without my involvement, so no worries there. Now, on to Give Me Three Steps.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the riff on this, man, this is just a great honky-tonk fight song with a great, great riff in it. It just shows how good of a riff writer and songwriter Collins really was to me.
Yeah, simple, but you know what it is right off the bat. I think this is an underrated, you know, you talk about greatest rock riffs. it's something that if you messed around with the guitar, you could probably figure out fairly easily, but you don't need anything fancy on this one. Like you said, this is a straight ahead bar room track. Apparently, like a lot of tracks that Skinner wrote, inspired by a true story. I guess Ronnie was talking to the wrong lady one night and somebody came in and was going to cave his head in.
Yeah. Suspected his wife was cheating and there she is dancing with this guy. And but see, and that was what makes it kind of a great country song, because it is a true story. It's even if it wasn't true, it's pretty relatable. You ever been in a bar talking to a girl, maybe dancing with her, maybe buying a drink, only to find out, uh-oh, she's a kept woman and I gotta get out of here, you know?
The guy in the corner with the smoke coming out of his ears. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Yikes.
So it helps him get on the chart. It helps him get a little little traction going there. And it was backed by a song called Mr. Banker, which is really a blues lament with some pretty good slide guitar in it, which may have been Ed King. I'm not sure. I think Ed and Gary wrote it with Ronnie.
Okay.
But it's basically about begging the bank to give him money to bury his old man. And so I didn't really know that song very well before we did research on this. I'm like, well, I bet they played that live if I had to guess.
Especially at the beginning when you didn't have a whole lot of stuff. I bet that's exactly what happened.
Mr. Banker, Mr. Please. Does money mean? Won't you reconsider, mister? Won't you do this thing for me?
Yeah, yeah, probably so. So, and it ended up on like the reissue, you know, in the aughts, I think it was. They reissued the first record, and I think they did a couple others with some live stuff as well. But hey, this is a big hit from them. They played this for years and years. I bet they haven't not played this like ever, to be honest with you.
You know, I was looking at this too. Apparently the place, The Jug, is still around in Jacksonville. Maybe the next time you're in town, we'll have to make a pilgrimage down there and see what's what.
I don't know, man. We could get our asses kicked just for driving by that place, man. I'm telling you, I mean, the side of town they grew up on is rough. It still is, man. You know, you don't want to go down there, you know, ordering a Michelob Ultra or something like that, man. You know, you got to come ready.
Do you have any craft cocktails here? Get this guy out of here.
Could you make me a Manhattan?
Sure, it's right around in the back. Bam.
But great rocker, and it's just, I have great appreciation for this riff. It's not a real complicated one, but it's good stuff, man.
Yeah, I have raunchy bar song written down for one of my notes.
Perfect. Absolutely captured it in its essence there, Jackson. No doubt about it. Okay, and then they wrap up the first side with Simple Man. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't know this song much as like a young man, but you know, I come to hear it later and they play it in commercials and in movies and stuff like this. I think this is one of the best songs that they've ever done. I think the lyrics are super poignant, and I think the music, and Rossington wrote this one with Ronnie. I think the guitar work at the beginning where they're kind of doing the run, you know, some minor run there, and then it's a little bit uplifting, and then they come up with a big riff is heavy. I mean, heavy, hard rock heavy. This is, it's a sad song. But it's also one of spirituality and hope and being true to yourself. And I think it encapsulates who Skinner were better than maybe any song they ever did.
Mm, interesting. interesting. Well, listening to this now, I was thinking to myself, when you just take a minute and listen to the lyrics, I think we could all maybe do with a little more following this along than being a jackass all the time with me first. It's words to live by. And yeah. You're right. It is the beginning part is awesome. And the bass is nice too, because it kind of goes along with the riff, but then it kind of sneaks in a couple extra notes there. That's one thing that kind of through this whole record, when you have two guitars and what will later become three guitars, it's hard for the bass to fit in, but they do, whoever's playing the bass, whether it's Ed or Al or whoever is doing that, they do a good job of finding space for the bass in these tracks.
Well, that's fair. Yeah. And having Ed on the bass, nothing against Leon, he's a fine bass player and all that, but just having someone who is a multi-instrumentalist and had been with other bands playing other things, mm-hmm. all the guys in the band can really jam, but this has kind of been their only band their whole lives for the most yeah. part, except for Ed, who's been around and seen maybe a little bit more than they had. And you're right, him carving out some spots with the bass, it's a little different, and it creates a little bit different sound than you would see in maybe later albums. And they don't ask him to do a ton with the bass on this one, but it plays a good role. And I never knew that it was basically about the death of Ronnie's grandmother, who may have actually sat him on her knee to tell him some of this stuff when he was a little kid, you know. So it's about, you know, forget your lust for the rich man's gold. Mm. All that you need is in your soul, you know. Go find a woman, you'll find love. Don't forget that there's someone up above. Simple words to live by sometimes, but true.
Yeah, still very relevant today.
Yeah, exactly. And then these badass riffs with some really nice guitar work by Gary. I mean, this is a hard rock song. This isn't a country song, although it's maybe got some country-ish lyrics. Between the riff and the solo, this is a hard rocking tune.
Yeah. And I think that's we have to put a label on everything, you know, they were the pioneers of what would become Southern rock, which, okay, I mean, I guess, but yeah, I don't think they ever got the credit for being straight ahead rock guitarists, because they had that kind of asterisk next to them. Oh, it's Southern rock.
Yeah.
No, this is smoking. The lead is smoking on this track.
It is. And it's got a sentiment that I think a lot of Southern people and country people can really relate to. You mm-hmm. don't have to be, though. You don't have to be from the South to relate to being simple, being true to yourself. Don't worry about all the outside stuff. Be a good person that your family would appreciate, you know, like the kind of person we raised you to be, that kind of thing. Like I said, I think it's right on with their philosophy of who they are in the world. And every time it comes on, I think I never turn it off. I'm like, wow, right. this is as good as it gets.
We're going to be here for a minute, because, yeah, I'm not getting out of the car.
That's right.
This is over.
That's right.
Hey, this is Scott Holiday from the Rival Sons. You're listening to The Ugly American Werewolf in London.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
But that wraps up side one, and then you flip it. Now, side one's kind of a powerhouse, if you ask me, right? I mean, it's start off with I Ain't the One, which is a rockin' tune, also very rock and roll sentiment, like, you know, beat it, baby. You can do better yeah. than me. Give Me Three Steps is a big hit with a fantastic rip. Tuesday's Gone is their number one ballad of all time. And then Simple Man, killer hard rock with an amazing message. Then you flip it to the second side. It's like, okay, most of these weren't going to be singles. And some of them are a little more country than they are rock. Mm-hmm. Before we get to the very end, would you agree with me there?
Absolutely. Yeah, there definitely is a tone switch here on the second side.
Yeah. Yeah. And it starts with Things Going On, which Gary wrote with Ronnie. It's more of a honky tonk track with Billy really tickling the keys a bit on this one. Not nearly as raucous as the stuff that you hear on the first side.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to admit, I've really had never heard this song before. But when you listen to it, like, is this a protest song? Are we getting a little bit heavy duty here on this one? Talking about, have you ever lived in the ghetto? You know, things are going on that you don't know. And there was a line about people living across the water or something like that, or being sent across the water. I'm like, is that about Vietnam? Like, what are we talking about here?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a little bit more going on in this band that they got credit than they had gotten credit for.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of Southern people in general are written off by people in the North and those, you know, in power, control the media, whatever you want to say. It's like, they're not articulate and they're not smart. Well, they may not always be articulate, but that doesn't mean that they aren't smart. And
correct.
I find that a lot of what Ronnie's lyrics say, if you really read into them, are a lot deeper than they look at first scratch. You know what I mean?
I would agree. I definitely would agree, because I think a lot of it kind of gets just kind of passed off with the, you know, the kind of the stadium anthem, or, you know, give me three steps, or, you know, talking about drinking and fighting and everything. But yeah, when you get into some of these, there is a lot more going on. I think he would have been a pretty interesting person to sit down and talk to, as long as he wasn't upset and wanting to kill you.
Right. He was sober. Yeah. But Ed King often said, like, because people always ask him, what was Ronnie really like? He said, you go pick out six songs, any six, doesn't matter which. You pick out six songs, you look at the lyrics, and that's who Ronnie was.
Yeah, very genuine person, it seems like.
Yeah. But this one, I mean, Bill's almost doing a Scott Joplin rag through some of this, you know, on here. And I love the guitar solo on it. It's a little more spare in the mix. I think Ronnie's voice is up front a little bit more. I love this one, but it does deal with some heavy stuff. And I think it's a well-written song. I don't know if I would have loved to hear it live, especially next to all the big rockers. But hey, I mean, it's got some heavy themes that are worth hearing.
Have you ever lived down in the ghetto? Have you ever fell down when the wind blow? Well, if you don't know what I mean, won't you stand up and scream? 'Cause there's things going on you don't know.
Yeah, and it's a nice album cut. It's a nice one to find in here and say, I mean, like you said, would I want to hear it live? Probably not, but it is cool to listen to it and to know that there's a little more than, like I said, the bar fighting and crashing cars into trees.
Exactly, yeah. Although the next one, Mississippi Kid, kind of goes kind of back into that, like, got my pistols in my pocket, you know. But this is an acoustic song, right? I mean, it's got some... it's a kind of an old blues song with some slide in it, and it might be Ed playing that slide. I'm not sure. It's like, it said Ed King plays lead.
Right. Yeah.
And but then Al Cooper is then playing the bass, but he also plays the mandolin on this one. And he and Burns got co-writes here, which is odd, because, I mean, Bob Burns, there's no drums on it. Maybe he helped with the lyrics, or maybe he helped with the melody or something like that. But it's a little different as far as the rest of them.
I got my pistols in my pocket, boys, my pistols in my pocket, boys, I'm Alabama-bound.
Yeah, it's interesting too that apparently Ronnie called himself, for reasons that no one really knew, the Mississippi Kid. And interesting that the plane ended up crashing in Mississippi. So very strange,
very
coincidence.
Odd.
Yeah. But this is a little bit of a dirtier song. And like you said, Ed is credited with being on the lead. I would assume that he played the slide. I don't know, but I thought that was weird too, that Bob Burns got the writing credit. Like, you didn't get anything else but this one. But yeah, this is another nice album track too to find.
I agree. And the acoustic work on here is great. And it fits in with the album, I would say, but it's not hard rock, like, at all. And I wonder how much they played it. I don't know much about their set list from the 70s. I mean, did they ever, like, slow down and do acoustic bits? I don't feel like they did.
I mean, I kind of think that back then you probably would have killed the moon with the acoustic number.
Yeah, you know, plus do all three guitars come out and play acoustic? Like, that's asking a lot. So I don't know. But It's an interesting one. And yeah, why did Ronnie always call himself the Mississippi Kid? It's a mystery. And right, the fact he died in Mississippi just adds to that, man. It's kind of weird. Now, the next song, Poison Whiskey. God, it sounds like something they all should have heeded a little bit more to me, you know? Yes. I mean, now Ed co-wrote this one. So this is his co-write on the album. Mm-hmm. And he does lay down some good bass here. So that's probably why he got some writing credit here. Leads by Gary and more fun keys from Billy. But there's Al Cooper on the organ again and talking about, you know, his daddy being born on Southern land was a street fighting man. You'd think Poison Whiskey, if you can write a song like that, you might heed your own warning there. But I mean, all the guys in the band, how many car crashes did Gary Rossington survive? Alan Collins basically ended his life with a car crash. He didn't. He survived another 4 years or so, but it's basically what killed him was that car crash.
Yeah.
And it killed his girlfriend. And it led to the point, you know, he couldn't play anymore. So that's got to be tough. But yeah, it's not, it's kind of coming back. I mean, after these two things going on in Mississippi Kid, this one's kind of getting back to kind of Skinner's sound, I feel like.
Yeah, it's more straight ahead. They're really not trying to tell you anything that you probably don't already know. There were a couple of pictures of Ronnie's father in the movie, and he looked like the kind of guy who might want to get drunk and fight. So maybe not that far off from real life.
It was a cage, baby, raised on some land. That's all my kinfolks tell me. The only thing that was wrong with him was Johnny Walker's red.
But you're right, the tales of what they would do when they were together, pretty much they were just always constantly drinking.
Right. You know, and that's what you do. And, you know, the thing is, too, it's like if you're if you're an accountant or something like that, or you're in business and people are like, hey, look, you got to clean yourself up. You got to stop doing this. You stop your drinking, then you might have to listen. But if you made it on your own out of a rough situation by being a rocker, right, who basically drinks and parties all the time, you know, you might figure, hey, that warning's for somebody else because I made it this way and I'm going to go out this way too.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's part of it too, is that might have been part of the culture of, you know, you were hard drinking, hard partying, just a tough guy. That's kind of what your outward appearance was. Like, that's just what you did. Like, there wasn't anybody that like, oh no, I don't really like drinking. Of course you do. Be quiet. Have some more.
Exactly. All right. So that's kind of revving it back up here to the penultimate song, the last song on side two, and that is Free Bird. One of the greatest rock anthems, epics of all time, written between Alan and Gary. And I guess they had it around for a while, but they just couldn't quite figure out how to piece it all together. And then eventually Ronnie's like, all right, hold on, put that middle part in there. Give me that. And then it was like, he wrote the song in 4 minutes.
It's amazing how when creativity strikes, you don't need sometimes it's just like a lightning bolt and you know what to do. I know that when they play it live, it's a tribute to Duane Allman.
Right.
But listening to this, I mean, I know Duane Allman was, you know, you talk about king of slide guitar. It will always be Duane Allman. But to hear Gary play this, I think he is very underrated as a slide guitarist.
I think he stands out very much on this track. You're absolutely right about that, Jackson, for sure. Yeah. And I didn't realize that it was actually Kathy Collins, who at the time was Alan's girlfriend, which first said, if I leave here tomorrow, would you still remember me? And I guess that kind of stuck in there. And that became the first line of the song. And it's a song about just being free, because that's what being American is all about.
Right.
And honestly, what being a Southern American is all about. You know, you don't want a bunch of Northerners coming down and telling you what to do. You want to be outside. You want to be hunting and fishing. And you don't need people telling you, you should do this, you shouldn't do that. And it goes, honestly, that attitude goes back to losing the Civil War. Now, look. Politically and sociologically, they should have lost the Civil War, but that doesn't mean that their culture was completely invalid. And right. They just carry it. So many of them carry around as a chip on their shoulder. Mm-hmm. Like, God, I wish we hadn't lost. Well, you had to lose for the good of the world. But, you know, that doesn't mean that, you know, everything you love and do isn't isn't all right.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think it is, or at least it was at that point in time, kind of, yeah, looked down upon, like, oh yeah, you're from the South. Go out and do your fishing and hunting or whatever.
Yes.
But, yeah, I mean, no disrespect to anybody. That's the way that you want to live. It's just a different way of life. And there's nothing wrong with being proud of that.
Exactly.
And it was interesting to me that, I know you said that they'd been around for a while, but to put something this epic out on the first record is pretty astounding.
I know, you know, and it, I mean, there's the big change before the 5-minute mark when all of a sudden there's all this jamming and you can hear Alan and Gary kind of trading back and forth and stuff like that, which is so epic. Being a 9-minute song is pretty rare, and it kind of ramps up like no other, right? Because like, you think of something like Layla, which is a long song, which has a big change. You know, it's a rocking song, and then it kind of has the pretty bit after it. Or something like Can't You Hear Me Knocking by the Stones, which is kind of a down and dirty song. And then it's kind of got this kind of South Seas kind of thing going on with, you know, with some horns and stuff at the end when it makes its big change. But this goes to being kind of a soulful, slowish song into being the biggest jam at the end in the history of the world, you know?
And it's nice too, because it was a chance for Ronnie to have a break too. Cause I mean, he's the only one that sings. So right. To have that like extra extended jam out song, you can just go and probably have some water, or maybe not.
Yeah. Something relax. Liquid anyway.
And relax, and then come back out there for the big finish. But yeah, I mean, even though it is 9 minutes long, it doesn't seem long to me at all. Like there are songs that you're like, okay, enough already. Here's another refrain, but this one doesn't feel like that. And once once it ramps up to the solo, you're talking about Collins not being your favorite. He is a beast.
He's awesome. Yeah, he is. Yeah, he's awesome. He wasn't my favorite when I was younger. I just probably didn't have a good appreciation for him.
Yeah.
But he's fantastic. He may have been the best of the three, to be honest with you. And, you know, honestly, in doing research, I really tried to pick out Ed's bass. And during the jam, he's doing some good work on that bass. He really is. You know,
I think they call it like walking it around. You know, you're kind of playing with the lead, but then you're also kind of doing your own thing. But yeah, it's really good on this one.
It's really killer, man. You know, and the thing is, it may be 9 minutes on the record, but they would play it live for like 15 minutes. You know, they would really stretch it out. And of course, it should be the last song of the album. You don't put anything after Freebird.
Right,
you don't listen to anything after that. And they closed, I think, every show they've ever done with Freebird, at least after the album came out, as they should have. It was actually backed with Down South Jukin. But here's an interesting kind of piece of the puzzle that, you know, I obviously wasn't aware of growing up. So really, Gimme Three Steps was the only single off the album. And then they went ahead and made Second Helping, a song that they had kind of come up with right towards the end of the sessions of the first album, was Sweet Home Alabama.
Okay.
So Sweet Home damn near got onto this record. If this record had had that on there.
Oh, man.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, out of the gate, your first record, and you've got Gimme Three Steps and Tuesday's Gone and Simple Man and Freebird and Sweet Home. That would be unbelievable. Okay, but they didn't. They saved it for the second record, even though it was recorded like in the summer of, I think like it was July of 73, and this came out August 11th of 73. So like too late to get it on the album. We'll save it for the next. So the first single was Gimme Three Steps. The second single they ever put out was Don't Ask Me No Questions, which was off of Second Helping in 1974. Then they put out Sweet Home Alabama a little bit later in 74, in June of 74. Then in November of 74, so like a year, more than a year after the first album had come out and after the second album had come out, that's when they released Freebird.
Interesting.
Which is interesting. And apparently the single version was only 4 minutes and 41 seconds. So I assume that means they completely cut out the jam at the end. I don't know if I've ever heard the singles version.
Yeah, I can't either, because I mean, I don't, by the time we caught up to it, it was just on album rock radio. So yeah, I don't, I don't really think I would care to hear the 4 minute version either.
No, no. It's like listening to Reaper with the solo cut out of the middle. Yeah. I'm like, where's the rest of it, man? Do you really not have an extra minute and a half to play the killer part of the song? Go fuck yourself. You know what the hell? So yeah, I don't want to hear the 4.5 minute, 5 minute version. You got to hear the whole thing. And honestly, sometimes I'd rather hear the 14, 15 minute version of it, you know?
So. I mean, like you said, if it's them trading licks back and forth, how could you not want to hear more of that?
Exactly. You know? And I think it's like the way Steve Clark auditioned for Def Leppard. Like he played the whole thing by himself. Like he's not trading with anybody. He's just trading back and forth on his own. You know, it's iconic. You know, it's huge guitar rock. Now, if I have to critique it at all, I'm going in to listen to it because I got to listen to it 4 or 5 times before we do the show.
Right.
It is a little repetitive. I mean, he's, you know, both Alan and Gary kind of do it with a little for 8 bars. It's like, okay, you can mix it up a little bit, you know. And then there's 4 bars of the exact same thing. Yeah, you're jamming. It's killer. But I mean, go give it a close listen. And it's like, well, he just did the exact same thing for 8 straight bars. Yes, it's rocking and it's cool and they're jamming and it's a blast. And live, I bet it's so much fun. But the fact of the matter is, they're not moving up and down the neck much. They're kind of, they get to one spot and they're like, and they kind of do the same thing over and over. I'm not saying I don't like it or that it's not good. I'm just kind of pointing out something that maybe we never really thought about before.
Yeah, yeah, and I could see how you would think that after a while, but it's just, I guess I've heard it so many times that it just, I know that's part of the song, so right. It doesn't really bother me, but yeah, I think if you sat there and really picked it apart, you would have that thought.
But obviously having this song, Freebird, I mean, that sets them up for stardom. They're guitar gods. They're a real hard rock band. It's not, they're not just like a country southern rock. They're a hard rock band. And Second Helping, I mean, I know it had Sweet Home Alabama, which was their biggest single ever on it, but that one went double platinum too. So you come out of the gate, boom, boom, 2 double platinum albums. That's a pretty big deal. And, you know, they got to open for The Who on the Quadrophenia tour because Al Kooper knew Pete Townsend, you know, so suddenly they get exposure to a lot more people. Not to mention, they could see, you know, how does a band who knows how to make some noise come out and do it, you know?
That was a crazy part of the story where it was, you know, Pete, I guess, said something to Al, like, hey, man, do you know anybody that could open for us? As a matter of fact, I do. Mm-hmm. And having them going and playing these giant arenas and then going home and playing bars again in front of, you know, 200 people.
Right.
It's just insane. But I think the other thing we got to think about is this band really was not around for that long. For the amount of material they put out and the amount of like hits that they had, I mean, it was really only 73 to 77 and that's it. And
that's
after
right.
that, it would, they were just, I mean, I think they did put out an album in the 90s or two or whatever, but I mean, the classic stuff was only just those few years.
I know. And being that when we first met, I was living in Jacksonville. I remember I went home one weekend and found out that Lynyrd Skynyrd in 1991 were going to the record store to sign records. So I'm like, well, hell yeah, I'm going to go down there and do it.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't want to buy the 1991 record because I didn't know it and it wasn't the original band. So I bought One More from the Road and had him sign that, even though obviously not everybody was on that, you know, record who was signing it, right? I mean, like, obviously Johnny Van Zandt wasn't on that record.
Right.
Got to meet Artemis. Gary looked rough then, dude. It was more than 30 years ago. I mean, I could smell them across the table. Like,
ooh,
Jesus,
boy.
Was the plane crash yesterday, fellas? Jesus. Because Gary looked rough. Now, Billy, God, I love Billy Powell. He just seemed like such a good dude, you know, like a happy guy,
yeah.
You know, personable. And I remember, if you ever watched the VH1 Behind the Music, Tom Wills was on WJXT as a young man then. Tom is, I think, still on WJXT, the big CBS station in northeastern Florida, which I'm sure you watch for your CBS News in southern Georgia there.
Uh-huh.
He must be 80 or close to it, but he's still on TV somehow. He had to go to the plane crash to cover the story for Jacksonville News. And Billy wasn't banged up that badly. I mean, I think it almost ripped his nose off, and you could see the blood all over his face. But God bless him, Billy's just standing there on TV with blood all over his nose, talking to Tom about, well, Billy, do you think there'll be a Lynyrd Skynyrd after this? And he has to say, I don't think so.
Oh, jeez.
You know?
And it, yeah, I saw that somewhere else. They didn't bring that up in the If I Leave Here Tomorrow. But yeah, Billy was the guy that stepped up and went and did all the pressers and everything, even though, yes, he wasn't injured as badly as some of the other people, but he was still in a plane crash. And to have him go out there like with his face all swollen and sunglasses on and just, you know, answer these questions. As a matter of fact, I can't even imagine what that was like. But yeah, he just seemed like a real nice down-to-earth guy.
Totally, you know. And then hearing the story about, because it's not like they all died on impact, you know.
Right.
They got Cassie out of the plane and she basically died in his arms. And he's like, God, I couldn't do that. I couldn't deal with that. Right.
Yeah.
You know, that's horrible. Of course, he lived another 30 years and I think he died of a heart attack. He was only 56 when he died, you know. It's like, and then, so, I mean, look, that's a lot of tragedy for one band. I mean, they lose Cassie and Steve and Ronnie. The band basically has to disband at that point. Then Alan, his wife dies in childbirth during labor for their third kid. Then he has a nasty car accident and his girlfriend dies and he's paralyzed. And Rossington has a bunch of them. And then, you know, kind of one by one, after Alan dies in 1990, they all kind of start to fall off, like Leon and Billy, and they all kind of start to fall off. And for the longest time, they had this agreement. And I think it was between Ronnie's widow and kind of surviving members of bands, like, we will never tour Lynyrd Skynyrd without at least three of the original or the Heyday members. But the problem with that is, if the band continues to make money and it helps the catalog continue to sell well and everybody still gets a piece of it, eventually they kind of have to break that promise and continue on. And now that Gary has passed away, not that long ago, there's basically no one left. There's zero people left, certainly from the original recording. You could say Ricky Medlock was there and then he came back, but nobody's left and they're still touring. I mean, I think they're touring with ZZ Top here. So I guess to celebrate the music, that's okay. I wouldn't want to go see him because there's nothing authentic about it anymore.
Yeah.
And I've chosen not to see them for a long time because, well, there's nobody really there anymore. But hey, look, if you love the band and you want to go celebrate those songs and hear them play live, I'm sure they still do it great because they can get top-notch guys to come in. But I don't know. It's too many generations past for me.
Yeah, it's basically just, I mean, it is a tribute band now.
Yeah.
But I think most of the guys have been there since, I mean, Ricky's been there since like the mid-90s. And on his second stint. And then a lot of the guys were there in the early 2000s. So, I mean, yes, no one's left from the original, but I think these guys have been playing together these songs for quite a long time. And, you know, they talked about Johnny, you know, filling Ronnie's shoes, but he's like, well, first of all, he never didn't wear shoes. And, you know, I'm just trying to celebrate the music. I don't think he's trying to be Ronnie Van Zandt.
No. And, you know, the thing is, he's trying to invoke his spirit. And Ronnie wasn't an extraordinary vocalist, but he was the front man. Like, these songs are about me, about my life, you know, and Johnny can, you know, embody that just as well in a lot of ways, you know,
right.
Grew up under the same roof, same parents, you know, knows the same stories, right?
So. Right. Correct.
That is our show on Lynyrd Skynyrd, pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd, approaching its 50th anniversary here. As someone who grew up in the Midwest and did some time in the South as well, you couldn't go anywhere without hearing some Lynyrd Skynyrd. It's a big part of the culture, and certainly if you're into rock and roll. When I lived in Jacksonville, I promise you, every fifth or sixth song on classic rock radio is Lynyrd Skynyrd. There might be two stations that I listen to a lot. I go from one to the other. I wouldn't have to wait long if I wanted to hear some Skynyrd. But it's great, good time, hard rock and music, maybe a little bit of a honky-tonk in there sometimes. Very straight-ahead, yet poignant lyrics that I think they don't get enough credit for. Certainly Ronnie Van Zandt doesn't get the credit he deserves as a songwriter. And I think there's some stigma about them being from the South. Like, oh, they can only be so good because they're from the South. Or we put them in this box where they're good, but they're not where other people could be. I don't know. I think that's getting old at this point. I think you need to appreciate the great rock and roll that they created. And certainly people down in Jacksonville and around that area still love Lynyrd Skynyrd to this day. And they're still going, even though there's nobody really in the band anymore who played on any of their big albums. Doesn't matter. It's still a brand. They're still out there. People still want to hear those songs played. So as usual, folks, we want to know, did we get something right? Did we get something wrong? Did we miss the point? Did we leave out your favorite part? You have to let us know. Email us. It's uglyamericanwerewolf@gmail.com. You can let us know the bands, the albums, the concerts, the DVDs, the books, the rock properties that you want to hear us talk about. Please follow us on Twitter at ugly_werewolf or at actionjack72. You can DM us. You can tweet us. We're also on Instagram. We're on Facebook. We're on YouTube. And if you're thinking about it, we'd love you to not only download and subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts, but also leave us a positive review. It's a huge help to us in trying to find more rock and roll fans like yourselves. If you're thinking about it, whether it's Apple or Spotify or Good Pods, anywhere you get your podcasts, give us a positive review. It would mean the world to us. And if you send it to us, well, we might just read it on the show. Thank you to Pantheon Podcast for making us a part of this amazing family of music podcasts. And thank you, of course, to RareVinyl.com, our sponsor. So if you're looking for that first pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd album, or really anything from a catalog of over 250,000 items, go to RareVinyl.com, use the code UGLY, and save yourself 10% off your purchases. Now, as far as next week goes, we're celebrating a very big American band this time, but we're going north of the border and to the South Pacific. That's right, we're going north of the border to speak with established iconic rock writer Martin Popoff, who's written more than 115 rock books over the years. And we're talking about his new book, his big, beautiful coffee table book called AC/DC at 50, which you can order now at martinpopoff.com. And it just highlights the band's career over the last 50 years at 50 salient points that were important to their history. It's a really fun conversation, and I can't wait for you to hear it. So as always, folks, until next time, be cool and stay safe.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.